The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 132.
Shattering Kingdoms with Evie Manieri.
That was your tagline?
Yes.
Aww. So apparently your intro to our show is discussing the destruction of kingdoms.
Have you not read any of the book yet?
Of course I read the book. I know exactly what's going on. I'm just saying it's very depressing. I mean, you couldn't have started with happy, like cool guys in cloaks riding on, like, flying monsters and stuff?
Have you not seen the cover? Have you not read the prologue?
I just thought we'd start this show with something happy and then get into the fact that the prologue doesn't give us a happy moment.
Anyway, I'm Paul, that's Sean, and our guest is Evie Manieri. Hello, Evie.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys.
Not a problem. So your new book, Blood's Pride, comes out next week on Tuesday, which is probably going to be the day this drops, so saying next week on Tuesday is probably meaningless, but it comes out soon, and I guess since you're a debut author, I want to know, what are you thinking this exact moment?
I'm trying to think as little as possible because that really only gets me into trouble. No, where my thoughts go is any place that anyone wants to be, especially me. So I'm doing my best to kind of step back as much as I can and, you know, do what I need to do to make sure people know about the book. But it's a journey for sure.
So how did this journey start for you? I mean, we usually ask everyone who's never been on our show, we ask them, you know, why did they get into writing and why are they writing genre fiction and those kinds of questions. So what was kind of your journey to this moment when you're having your first novel published?
It's a long one. I started writing seriously. My first serious writing was when I was in college, and it was, not to be depressing, but it was right after my father passed away. Oh, and wow. I just needed an outlet, something creative to sort of get me through a tough time. I was living in my college apartment over the summer, which, you know, was obviously pretty lonely. There weren't a lot of people there. So I had this big block of time and very little to do. And I started writing then, and I continued on with that novel. I finished it after I graduated, and it's in a drawer somewhere. No one will ever see it, and that's exactly where it should be. But then I found that I just had to keep writing. So when I was finished that book, I started another one, and that I wrote that for a while, and I eventually abandoned that project and I started this one. And this book was written over and over again, many times over a long period of time. They were in stops and starts. So it's been a long time coming to this point. When I finally had a draft that I was happy with, I started looking for an agent, and I queried 99 agents before I got my agent that I'm with now. So that in itself was a process. And then it just kind of went on from there.
And now you're getting Blood's Pride will be published through Tor, which is certainly one of my favorite publishers. And I mean, what was the process like working with the folks at Tor?
The folks at Tor have been amazing, just from start to finish. My editor, Stacey Hill, is just wonderful. She's a wonderful person. She's a wonderful editor. She made the process extremely painless. I have felt very well supported by them. They're doing wonderful things that I could never have dreamed of doing myself. I mean, self-publishing was never even something I considered because I just don't have the skill set for the business end of it, and I know that very well. But, I mean, look at the cover. The cover is just phenomenal. So it's been wonderful working with them. I'm extremely happy there.
So I guess to kind of jump into the book, Paul had mentioned earlier when we argued for a very long time over the tagline, the prologue, and I'm not ruining anything because everyone who reads this, it's like in the first couple pages of the book. So if this is going to ruin the whole book for you, go cry in a river or something. no, but in the very first pages, it's written almost kind of like a mythical kind of story about what happened to this culture when these new people arrive. And that is essentially becomes the historical backdrop for our main story. And one of the interesting things I thought about that, or what the thing that kind of interested me about that is, this is the kind of narrative that's about a conquered people and their relationship with essentially their conquerors. And so a lot of the kinds of themes and issues that have kind of crop up here are related to the tensions between those groups, particularly like religious conflicts. And of course, there's this the issue of slavery. And I was kind of interested, what kind of compelled you to write a story about essentially the relationship between a conqueror and the conquered people?
I think I find those stories from history fascinating, that relationship. But I think it was less about a conquered and a conquered people than it was about people who are somewhere they have no business being. So you have, you know, the Norlanders here in this environment that physically is hostile to them. And they're trying to run this colony in under really adverse circumstances. It was really about the contrast between the two cultures that I wanted to show. And I think, you know, the issue of slavery is an interesting one because I realized that there's another book here. You know, there's another, you could have written this book in a very different way where the issue of slavery is really at the front, and it's not. You know, that's not where the focus is. It's on the individual characters and the way that they become translators of a sort, the way they cross the lines of their races and their political situations based on, you know, just their affinity and their ultimately their affection for each other.
I wanted to talk a little more about the opening. The opening does have a visceral, I got a horror-like feel to it. Was that intentional?
Not really. I mean, the perspective of the person who's writing the prologue, because obviously the prologue is written in someone else's voice, is this incredibly pivotal moment in his life, even though he was a baby. So he's imagined this moment that he wasn't really present for over and over and over and over and over again. It is like a nightmare. It's like his nightmare that he can't escape from. So in that respect, yes, it does have that sort of inescapable, you know, horrific feel. But I wasn't intentionally trying to sort of set up a horror situation because that's definitely not where the book is going. At least I don't think it's where it's going.
That's not where the book goes, but it's like an immediate impact, and then the book goes on to the present day, for lack of a better word.
Right.
But it's just a very sharp, a short, sharp shock at the beginning. I was just wondering if that was an intentional move on your part, whether you liked the tropes of horror and you like to make those evocations, What was that phrase? School of flesh-eating fish, for example. It's just like, I'm thinking, ay, ay, ay.
I was just looking for images that captured the moment. I'm not actually a big horror fan. I don't read horror. So wherever those came from, they just came from trying to visualize what this was like, this, like you said, short, sharp attack. on this very unsuspecting people, and what that felt like, and how alien their invaders were, how difficult it was for them to even relate to them in that moment as something akin to themselves. They have a supernatural feel in that moment. And that's part of it too. You know, there's this, you know, the two sides sort of judge each other. They make assumptions based on that initial meeting. And then we find a generation later, you know, what has happened to those assumptions? Are they still in place? Are they beginning to crumble around the edges? You know, what is that? The assumptions are a big, I think, a big thematic element in this all along.
Yeah, I definitely would agree with, I have to agree. You wrote the book.
But, you have to agree.
But I do, that is really interesting, the kind of thinking about the different kinds of assumptions that come with the different, class maybe isn't quite the right word, but like some of your Norlanders, I mean, there are lots of assumptions about, you know, this guy is like this because he is in this class, and so he must therefore be like this, but then you kind of learn when the characters get developed more, we learn more about them. They don't actually fit that mold, and in some senses, they're actually kind of pushing back at the mold that's being pushed on them. Like, for example, the main Norlander, Eofar?
Eofar, right.
Yeah. In a large sense, is not particularly happy with the position that he is given as a result of being essentially royalty. And he finds kind of his own different ways to kind of push against that and kind of working to get the elixir that's in some of the early pages, and even kind of rejecting some of the traditions that are handed down as like written law almost. He has this conflict with Aisa, who's his sister, who wants to challenge her older sister in order basically have a certain right that would be granted, but she can only get it through this challenge, and he's just like, whatever, like it's she's not even really interested in fighting you can just take the damn thing, just, and she's like, but it's tradition, it's the way the world is supposed to be, and he's like, eh, whatever,
right.
He's not really like
trying to cling to that that scrap of what she believes is, you know, something normal and something real that she can hold on to, and he's just kind of over it. Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's one of those, I want to say almost like a trope. It's a very, not specific to fantasy so much as it is to stories which do involve people pushing against tradition. That's almost like a very human thing, almost, as the way, which is a weird thing to do because I'm not sure that they're what they are, whether they're human or like some sort of like mutated human-like people, or they're actually aliens or something. But because there's another question I'll have about their weird physiology. But it is, it seems like it's a rather human quality, and I'm not sure if that was something you had thought about, you were intentionally trying to kind of explore that pushing against tradition or the status quo, as it were.
I think that, I don't know that I framed it in exactly those terms, but I definitely was doing something like that intentionally. I think one of the things I wanted to explore was the tension between what you feel like you're supposed to be and what you actually are. And the tension that just keeps mounting as you try to either become one or the other, either you push against it or you try to fit the mold better. The cognitive dissonance, the internal tension that gets created and churned up, and then the different ways that, you know, we act that out, or we allow it to dictate our actions. So that was definitely something that was on my mind, was the idea of the role versus the individual. And in Norlan culture, the role is very important. So I think it plays out most specifically in the Norlanders.
But that's definitely true, because the quote-unquote king of the Shadari. He... Eofor meets him at one point in early in the book, and he basically wants to refer to him as king, and he's just like, yeah, I'm king, but it's not really that big a deal. We just have kings because we kind of need them.
Oh, you mean Jakaad?
Yeah.
The Gnomus King, yeah. Yeah, well, the Gnomus.
Sorry, Gnomus, yeah.
They're funny because they're so loose. You know, they're just so easy. So, yeah, exactly. He is definitely their king, but he's such a different king than the Norlander idea of a king.
Yeah, and it is interesting that from that kind of royalty perspective, he is rather loose. But when it comes to some of the other traditions, for example, the same culture, the women go to sea and the men go to the desert. It's like it's like a weird, almost like penguin like thing. I mean, kind
that's
of.
That's hilarious.
But he explains that, you know, this is just the way that's always been. The king thing is whatever, like, I'm king, who cares? But that is the thing that is just, it's not so much a law, it's just that's just the way it is, and people are just inclined towards this.
Right.
And that's very different from AFR, who is kind of going, like, I don't really care about a lot of this stuff, I kind of want my own thing, and... Yet, I think they're just interesting as kind of, not foils, but certainly opposites in very different ways. You know, status is important for the Norlanders, and yet he kind of is slightly rejecting it, and status means nothing it means something, but it doesn't mean anything to the character.
Right.
And yet these other traditions are what really do matter. I don't know if that, I'm just kind of rambling, so maybe if Paul actually has a question here.
I do. There is a rich stew of cultures, ideas, characters. You mentioned this was rewrote this novel several times to get it to where did this novel start, Evie?
It started with the mongrel coming out of the desert.
Ah, okay.
That was the image that was fixed in my head from the very beginning. And everything else just grew up around that and the story, her story that I wanted to tell. And she's a pivotal character. She is the pivotal character. I mean, she's the catalyst for everything. And yet all these other stories are happening around her. But she's always, no matter how it reads, she's always at the center.
And she's really cool.
Yeah.
She Fortune's Blight, and in the next book she gets a lot more screen time per se.
Oh, okay. I'm not gonna tell anybody that I know where that title comes from.
Spoilers.
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 I won't say anything about that because people will figure it out. They'll try to find the clues in the episode. And that would be bad because then they would know exactly where the title comes from without having read the book.
Yeah.
And that would be dangerous. I'm sorry. So kind of going off of Paul, jumping off of the interesting mixture of cultures, and it kind of goes back to kind of one of the questions I was asking earlier. There is a lot of very interesting ways that the cultures interact, and I was really fascinated. There's one scene early in the book where you have a bunch of soldiers, Norlander soldiers, and they're just talking about basically kind of random stuff, what seems like random soldier stuff, and they're ribbing each other. And in the middle of this conversation, we learn that the slave people, their religion doesn't have a written component. And so when they see written materials just lying out, they will actually take it and burn it. And this becomes one of this moment where the one soldier's talking to the other one and he's saying, don't leave that out because the servants will come and get it and they'll burn it and you'll never see it again. And I believe the book is actually the Norlander of either it's their religious text or like their code of conduct or something of that nature. And I was very interested in what was kind of the impetus by or where did these kinds of cultural elements come from? Like you say you drew on sort of like ancient or older historical accounts of various conquerings and intermixings of peoples. What was kind of the impetus behind this particular, I guess, conflict may not be the right word, but certainly they're not seeing eye to eye on that particular issue.
Culture clash.
Yeah, culture clash. Like, culture clash.
Well, you know, the two cultures, they're both cultures that really developed in isolation. I mean, we don't see Norland in this book at all, so we don't really know that much about Norland yet. But there's a lot of mirroring. I'm big on mirroring, and there's a mirroring aspect between Norland and the Shadar, and it's also a very isolated culture. So the culture clash really comes out of that, these things developing in isolation. So the Shadari have a very specific reason why they do not allow writing, which I can't talk about because it's a big spoiler. So that is the fact that writing is taboo is a big part of the religion. Whereas my feeling is that any culture that's evolved to any extent is going to have writing. So, you know, the Norlanders have writing because they're a fairly sophisticated culture, and of course they're going to have writing. So it's more a question here of why don't the Shadari have writing? Why they consider it so dangerous and so toxic? And it hurts my heart a little bit every time I even think about burning or destroying a book. But I think that is also something that sort of resonates with readers that, wow, something's wrong here. Now, this is not a good thing.
Yeah, it's actually, when you put it in those terms, it's a little bit disturbing. Because book burnings, I mean, they still happen today, although I can't say that with any surety, because there are probably places in the world where book burnings occur as a matter of course. But if book burnings happen here, they're usually, you know, isolated to one micro community in a much larger community. So like in the U.S., occasionally we get a book burning. You know, maybe some church or some other group or whatever decides we don't like all this stuff, so we're going to burn it all. And we haven't seen mass book burnings, at least not in this country, at least in the West, in 60 years, 70 years. World War II would have been. Was that the last time we saw mass book burnings?
In the West, yeah, I think that sounds about right. Nazi Germany, yeah.
Yeah, and that goes to really the question. I mean, if a culture that is concerned with what is written, there is, I think, a very real danger. I'm using danger very loosely, to the written form, since words themselves have consequences. They have influence and
power,
and not having that kind of keeping that away from a people gives a certain degree of control, I guess, if you prevent people from having access to contrary views, I guess is one way you could put it, as a way of control. And that maybe is for a culture that has been a certain way for so long, that becomes very ingrained and actually quite terrifying when you meet another culture that can, that has to a certain degree open expression, or more open expression, I guess is the way to put it.
Sure, that's definitely true. And, you know, this isn't, you know, for the people who haven't read the book, obviously, it's not, they don't burn books because they take issue with what's in them. You know, writing is considered any kind of writing by lay people, because the priests are dead, as we find out in the prologue, no spoiler there. It's offensive to the gods. It's blasphemy. It's, you know, the price for that is damnation. So it's more of a religious observance than it is about suppressing information for them, for the Shadari people. And we learn a lot more though behind the impetus for that aspect of their religion, you know, through the course of the book. So,
yeah, no spoilers, although that was a really kind of chilling moment in the prologue when the priests, just jump off and die.
Yeah.
I read that and I was like, what the? Like, mostly because I'm just going to ruin the prologue. I'm sorry. I'm just going to ruin it for people.
The prologue's online, so it's not a problem.
Yeah. So when you read the prologue, the basic idea is, I'm just going to boil it down to its most simple. Weird ass ships show up. They look all beat up, and people are like, who the hell is that? We should go investigate. And they're like, nah, we're just going to hang back. And then at night, all of a sudden, all of this weird shit comes out of them and starts just rah, just like killing people and slaughtering all of these innocent people, presumably innocent. I mean, who knows? Maybe they were all evil. and then they go back to their ship. And then the people are like, well, what the heck? And they look up to the big temple-y place, and they're like, you guys are supposed to help us. What the hell's going on? And they're like, hey, look. And nobody shows up. So the next day, the bad people come back, and they kill more people, and they steal more stuff, and they're all like, just killing. And the guy, all the people are looking up and going, what the hell? And then the next day, they finally go, oh, there's a sign they're going to do something. And then they look up, and all of the priests are jumping to their deaths. And that's basically how the story more or less ends. And I mean, just imagine, if you will, if you were the people and you're being slaughtered and you're hoping that the people that are supposed to protect you will protect you. And then you look up and you see them killing themselves. I mean, that's there's no hope after that.
Right.
That's it. It's over. Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks for that. I now have no hope. I'm just teasing. But it is the way it's written, and there's a reason why I call that almost like a myth. It's probably more accurately called like an oral history, but written in that way that you would expect traveling storytellers to tell it. It is quite chilling when you think of it from a cultural perspective of a people who, whether that's 100% what happened or not, that is kind of ingrained in a kind of cultural consciousness, that feeling of basically there's no hope, that there's nothing we could have ever done to stop this, and now we're stuck here.
Definitely. It's a hard stop. You know, there is no place to go from that. And then, you know, when we pick up the story, we see, you know, what happens to a generation that has grown up in the shadow of that moment.
Paul, did you, go for it, Paul.
Yep. So I understand you have a degree in history, and I was just wondering what were some of the historical inspirations for Warrior Universe. I mean, the whole breaking up of people. I hearken back to myself thinking about things like the Neo-Assyrians getting trampling other cultures and then getting trampled in turn, and numerous other examples in history where isolated cultures finally smack together and shit happens. Pardon my language. I was just curious. I was curious, since you do have a background in history, what historical periods or cultures or ideas did you pluck for your universe?
It's going to be a very disappointing answer, I'm afraid, Paul. I just made it all up. It really, my studies in, I have, it's just a bachelor's degree in history. So first of all, let's make sure we don't make it sound like more than it is. You know, and it was mostly, I studied mostly medieval history, popular history. It was a very scattershot kind of approach to learning history. I just sort of took the classes that sounded interesting at the time, and I read what came across my way. So, you know, I would nowhere near call myself even an amateur historian. So, I mean, all that stuff filters in, and it's all sort of there in the background of my consciousness, but I didn't consciously pluck anything from anywhere. It all just evolved out of creating these cultures in relationship to each other and to tell the story that I wanted to tell.
So it might have been more, not that you're drawing on, I mean, subconsciously, I'm sure you drew on something, like we just
did that
naturally, but more of you developed the cultures in response to each other, so you would maybe, I'm making it seem like methodical, but it's probably not quite as methodical, but like, you know, you'd set up a culture doing X, and then you say, well, how does this other culture respond to that culture doing X? And that kind of becomes the back and forth of developing the cultures, perhaps?
There's some of that, but oftentimes it would come out through the story that I wanted to tell between the relationships of the characters and the kinds of stresses that the cultural divide would have on them. But, you know, a lot of it just comes out of trying to think these things through. You know, what do I know about the culture, and what's a way that I could see that culture developing and the kinds of mores that they would bring into their world? What their necessities were, you know, what did they have, how do they respond to their environment? It's just asking lots and lots and lots of questions. And there's plenty that never made it to the page. you know, which I think is always true with world building.
It's the iceberg. We only see 1/10 of what you have been building and thinking about ever comes across to the reader. It's all in your mind or in some Word file on your computer, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a big believer in only showing what is relevant to the story. So I try to keep that stuff in the background. But, you know, it informs everything that you do, and it pops out in different ways, and it creates interesting moments and interesting set pieces and, you know, props. That whole business with the book, you know, in that was one of the last scenes written, actually, that scene with the soldiers in the barracks with them throwing the book around. You know, and all that stuff about the writing was well in place and established in my mind before that scene was ever even approached.
So you sort of added that, I mean, later on in the writing process?
Yeah, that was one of the, because the character of Ro, who is such an important character, was introduced very late in the manuscript, and it didn't work. We didn't get to know him before things started to heat up, and so Higo was getting kind of lost. And there was a lot about New Orleans culture that was, I think, being taken too much for granted in the early portions of the book. So that scene was a way of introducing Ro's character in a moment of normality for them before things start to go haywire. So we get a sense of what this place looks like running on a normal day-to-day basis. If you don't establish that, then things are chaotic, but you don't have no idea what came before, so it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you have no anchor, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Sean.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that it's so interesting to hear that was something you added later, because I just can't imagine the book without that scene. it seems such a perfect place to put that.
It's a keystone, yeah.
Yeah, I really feel... I'm complimenting you in my silly way of doing it, but I do think that that's a really, really crucial scene for the narrative. I think that you obviously noticed it as a writer, that there were issues later in the book without that scene, but that's pivotal, I think. One of those really important scenes where it doesn't seem important at first, but it becomes a very, very crucial scene as you get through the story. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, there were things that were, there's information that comes through in that scene that was in other places that it didn't belong. That became evident very quickly as I created that scene. I'm like, oh, this is where we'll establish that. Oh, this is where they can talk about that. As opposed to these spatterings of information in other places in the narrative that were interrupting the action and they were interrupting the flow. So it was... Once the idea came to put that scene in, it made perfect sense. But, you know, that's a scene that happened in my head anyway. It wasn't on the page at first, but it's not like I didn't have the image of them sitting around in the barracks, you know, shooting the BS soldiers, you know, and insulting each other and getting on each other's nerves in this, you know, lousy posting that they have.
Yeah, and they hate it. It should be noted they don't like it there.
There's no reason why they should like it there.
I do like the thing that I find really cute about that scene is, yes, on the one hand, it's these very serious issues, but on the other, it's, you know, it's almost comical. I mean, it's not written like a comedy, but there's these comical elements, like, you know, the two soldiers, Ro and I'm gonna draw a blank on the other, his friend, and they both come from higher upbringing, I guess,
right?
And the other soldiers who don't, and they kind of push against each other in you're from one of those tribe people, you know, the higher ups, and you're thinking you're gonna get a good posting because you've got all this class and high to do and all that nonsense, but no, there's something that you did with some guy's daughter, and it you're stuck, buddy.
You're a screw up, basically. That's where the screw ups go.
Basically,
I was reminded a bit of the 13th Warrior that way.
Oh yeah, where Antonio Banderas, who is not Middle Eastern at all, he gets sent off.
He gets sent off to a crappy posting because, well, what he did in the Caliph's court.
Yep, can't do it. And then they send him to the random island of Vikings someplace.
Random Island of Vikings sounds awesome.
It's actually really quite. I like that movie.
I've never seen it.
It's basically like a retelling of Beowulf.
Oh, okay.
Kind of. And despite the fact that Antonio Banderas is not Middle Eastern, it is a pretty good movie. But it basically follows the basic idea of Beowulf. Only the main character is not a warrior. He is a
poet
slash makeshift translator, or well, he's supposed to become one. How he's supposed to do that, I don't know, because he doesn't speak any other language but his language. but basically, yeah, that's the basic idea, and it's I believe they're supposed to be like a Viking culture.
It is the Viking. It is he's dealing with the Rus and with the Vikings, and we shouldn't reveal what the Beowulf really is, because that'd be spoiling the movie, and we shouldn't do that.
No, but when the reveal happens, it's actually even more cool than the Beowulf story, I think. So, yeah.
So, but yeah, but that the whole you're high class, but you wind up in a crappy posting because of what you did. Yeah, my mind immediately went to that movie.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you have that Rose friend Deem. He's eating the candy. You know, he's not taking anything seriously. So you get a pretty clear sense. It's never said why he got sent there, but you get a pretty clear sense that this is not a guy who's going to be a success anywhere.
It's actually kind of sad. Like, these people get stuck in the butt end of the world, and they just know, like, whatever, I just don't care anymore because I'm not leaving this place. It's very sad.
Yeah, takes 5 years to get a transfer out of there. But, you know, it's who those people are is and why they're there and sort of their makeup is essential to the way the story unfolds. So if they were the rank and file Norlanders, the story would not play out the way it does.
Yeah, I mean, that would be that's definitely true, because, of course, they would be more rigid. And these are people who have presumably made mistakes, although some of the mistakes that they've made are maybe not. We might not consider them such big deals, but for that culture are maybe more problematic. But they're
grudges, you know, they have grudges. They feel disgruntled. They feel, you know, pushed aside. They're not happy with their situation. I don't think many of them feel like they deserve to be there.
Well, I would assume not, or they wouldn't have grudges. I guess if they knew that they belonged there, it'd be a totally different question.
But I think that's the thing. I think Deem knows he belongs there.
Which is probably why he doesn't care so much, and he's just,
exactly,
yeah, he just kind of has that nonchalant way of going about things. He's just kind of like, I'm gonna eat the candy, whatever.
Yeah, he just he picks on the other guys that he feels are inferior and less intelligent for his entertainment. That's pretty much it.
So just to kind of really switch gear, because we're talking lots and lots about culture and those kinds of things. But one of the interesting things about your two peoples, or well, there's more than two, but the two, I guess, the ones that interact the most, which is the Shadari and
the Norlanders.
The Norlanders. One of the interesting things that you've done with them is you've offered physiological differences, and one of those differences is these two people can't actually touch, because the Norlanders are basically like an ice people. They come from very cold environments, and these other ones, the Shadari, are from a warmer climate, but that it's not just a matter of like that they come from different climates. It's their skin literally hurts one another if they come into contact.
Right.
And I'm really curious, what was kind of what got you to develop that difference? I mean, why would you not just have like one of them bitching and moaning about it being so warm and the other one saying, it's so cold up in the north? It's actually, you know, no, it's cold, it's warm, yada, yada. But also, we can't actually touch because that hurts like hell.
I think that's the relationships, I guess you would call them the romantic relationships. You know, it's sort of a key component of, I think that's where it came from, was what are we willing to risk for love? What are we willing to accept, and the boundaries that we're willing to push? I mean, if you put your hand in a fire and it hurts just as much as it would hurt to put your hand in that fire, but you know that your hand wouldn't actually burn, how long would you hold your hand in that fire? You know, would you keep doing it? Would you wait to see what would happen? Would you wait to see if you got used to it? You know, what are we willing to do? What are we willing to risk? I mean, on a really superficial and silly level, you know, it's sort of love hurts. You know, are you going to go into a relationship with someone knowing that there's always going to be pain?
Good gosh.
You didn't look at it from that perspective, or?
No, I mean, I can see that. It's just a matter of now it's a very different, I'm just actually trying to imagine that scenario. I mean, how would intimacy work between two individuals who touching each other is painful, in a literal sense? And then also that develops into a very psychological sense, because if you know touching somebody will be painful, that creates a kind of psychological pain of knowing that there's the distance that's always going to be there.
That barrier, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's also the nature of pain. You know, there's people who crave pain. You know, there's pain as a release. You know, there's all different kinds of ways of experiencing pain. And I think the different characters in this feel differently about it, and in different times too. I think it means something different to them, the people who are willing to take on that challenge.
So in some sense, I mean, even though it plays into the much larger issues between the cultures, that this physiological difference is literal and also sort of a metaphor, as
Absolutely.
It were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. It's a very big, very extended metaphor, and you could almost think of it as it's not even just about the romantic relationships. It could also be a way of thinking of metaphorically thinking about the kinds of distances between these cultures, and that maybe to have to acknowledge. I'm being English major. I'm sorry, but acknowledging that, you know, that these two cultures, in order to have any kind of serious rational interaction, there's going to be a sense of pain, in part because the relationship all of them start with, which is one of a essentially a conqueror and another one of a generation of people who've lived under that conqueror, as it were.
Right. I mean, Darian has that moment. I mean, it's pretty far on in the book, but he has that moment where he's been fooling himself, and he kind of sees that in its starkness in this one particular moment that, you know, that past doesn't matter what happens now, that past is not going to be erased. No one's going to forget that happened. No one on either side is going to be able to forget that.
And would we expect them to? And I think the answer to that is no.
No, right? Yeah. I wouldn't think it would be. You couldn't. It's more than you could ask.
It's actually. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, especially given how you've set up the cultures, tradition, how they're fighting against what they're supposed to be and who they are. So yeah, you set up those dominoes quite nicely that way.
Thank you.
And it's a really useful, I think, to and if you read this book and you think about its relation to a contemporary time. I mean, you know, in a way, it's like trying to put yourself in another kind of person's shoes. And this is maybe one of the reasons why I think that genre fiction is such a great source, because I think for a lot of people it becomes a safe way for us to actually think about other peoples that maybe is not the same in our world, like where we might I'm not going to use any real world example just because I don't want to piss anybody off, but but you know, where we might say like, oh, we're in a conflict with said people, and when you ask people who are in that conflict, well, look, pause and put yourself in their shoes, try to imagine what they feel. That becomes very difficult in the real world, where in genre, I mean, we're dealing with people. These people don't exist in the real world. I mean, I hope not. Gosh, that would be really weird. but they don't exist. But we can sit there and we can go, we can insert ourselves to a certain degree into these different peoples. And it gives us a way of maybe getting at some of those tensions we can't deal with in the real world. I don't know if you agree with that or Paul agrees with that, but that.
I totally agree with that. And I think that's why. Not only am I drawn to fantasy, but I think that's why I'm working with, I guess, I mean, epic, it's been labeled epic fantasy. I guess epic is maybe the closest. I'm not sure that I'm entirely comfortable with that label, but you know, it's employing all these different perspectives, having the perspectives of these different characters all over this conflict. That is really key to the story that I wanted to tell. So I agree with that completely. I think genre fiction, fantasy, and sci-fi, you know, is a perfect place to do that. I mean, I think that's what, like, you know, if you look at, you know, like Star Trek Next Generation, and you sort of, if you examine it from sort of an issue of the week point of view, and those things come out really clearly, you know, okay, this is an episode about racism. You know, it's all there.
That actually dovetails into what I was going to ask you. First, I was going to make a side comment. I do think there's much more to fantasy than just sword and sorcery and epic level. In fact, I've done some thoughts about how you set the stakes. And this feels more like a kingdom level fantasy. There's a bunch of them out now in this part of my life. Excuse me. This just seems to be one of a number of novels that seem to be working in that area between the full wide scale, we're going to fate of the entire world versus the fate of two people. This seems nicely somewhere in between. And I appreciate that. That's been an underdeveloped stratum of fantasy that I'm glad to see getting more and more play. But I was curious what your reading interests and background were as far as reading genre fiction, especially fantasy, and what you might have taken from those authors and books.
You know, I read a lot of non-genre fiction, and I honestly think that I'm probably been influenced more by that reading than I have by my genre fiction reading. But you know, I've read, when I was a kid, I fell in love with Anne McCaffrey. I mean, Fire Lizards, they just did it for me. So you know, I was like a 9 or 10 year old. I read through all her books, and I think that sort of whet my appetite. And then I read, I remember reading Terry Brooks around that same, when I was around that same age. But I also loved The Wrinkle in Time, and I read all the Roald Dahl books. So he was, you know, that's not genre fiction, but it to me it is. You know, these are fantasies. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is a fantasy. James and the Giant Peach is a fantasy. I love those books so much, and I remember James Thurber's The 13 Clocks and Norton Juster's The Phantom Tollbooth. These were books, yes, that I read every, you know, I would read those 2 or 3 times a year, you know, when I was in junior high. And then even in high school, I would read them over and over again. So those books were enormously influential. I think my adult reading didn't really influence that much, me that much. I think I was kind of already on my own thing. And I just had this thing in mind that I wanted to do that was just sort of coming out of me. So, but I think, you know, writers like Charles Dickens influenced me. I think with the, you know, I think of a lot of Dickens as sort of magical realism in the way that the storylines interact and people find these connections that, you know, in reality probably wouldn't happen. But there's this sort of magical connectedness to everything that I find really appealing and lovely. I think I like Wes Anderson movies for the same reason. This idea of this drawing together of these disparate people into something as a group. There's something that's more than they were when they were, you know, sort of wandering around on their own. It's that sensibility that I really like.
You may be the first person to say I was influenced by Charles Dickens on this show. Just thought you should know that. This is a first.
I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
I mean,
it is a good thing. I'm related to him, actually.
Really? Oh,
gradually. What?
You knew that, Sean. I'm descended through his sister.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're almost like a famous person.
My mother worked at a restaurant in Philadelphia for a while called the Dickens Inn that was run by his grandson or great-grandson. It was very cool. Very cool place.
That is really cool. And I actually think that I like Dickens. I know a lot of people hate Dickens.
Yeah, people get really down on him.
I can understand, though. His work is... I will say it's not the kind of book that I'll take to the beach on a fine sunny day and read. Because it's just not gonna, there'll be too much cognitive dissonance, I think. But I mean, you know, like The Tale of Two Cities is, I mean, most of people in high school hated that book. I actually really liked it. And he is an extraordinary writer. And then everybody loves the most famous one. Ah, Christmas one. What's
the name? Oh, the Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol. Thank you. Sorry, I've totally blanked out. I was going to say A Christmas Story, and I was like, wrong movie. But like
that.
Yeah, it's a good one though. But everybody knows that story, and I think it's been reworked so many times that people don't realize maybe that they are Dickens fans through that story.
Because that story is so embedded in our culture now in so many different ways. Yet it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Doctor Who did not last year, but the year before they did a version of it. For Doctor Who, there was the Muppets version,
which we watch every year, and I like that Doctor Who episode.
They're both great. And there are so many different versions of it that are just retold, and I think it's one of those stories that, as you were just kind of saying, and you said it better than I could, it's just become embedded in our culture, in a way that. People just don't realize how influential his work was on everything. And not quite everything, but, you know, so influential that he's everywhere. And yet we don't even realize it unless you're like weirdos like us who like Dickens. But and that happens a lot in literature. People forget, like for a while, Tolkien was not. I mean, he was well regarded by certain quarters, but he was not as popular as he is now.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's fair to say. I think even Tolkien people would admit, like, yeah, his books were not selling as much as they are now. And yet, you know, you couldn't look at fantasy and not see the influence of his work, because basically he more or less started the popular fantasy genre, the epic genre that we're familiar with.
Right.
And in a weird way, we're all indebted to Tolkien in that same way that our Christmas is indebted to Charles Dickens.
That's true. And the first book that I wrote was very much in the Tolkien-esque vein. I mean, it was awful. Don't get me wrong, but it followed along sort of what you'd consider sort of that traditional walking through the woods kind of thing. And, you know, but I even think, you know, I look at this book that I've just written and it's also influenced by Tolkien and that it's a departure from it. You know, maybe I wouldn't have gone with this particular setting if I wasn't looking to get out of the woods. You know, I might have gone somewhere completely different. So even as fantasy breaks away from it, I think there's a self-consciousness to that breaking away.
It's a tradition, yeah. Actually, in fantasy. Tolkien was... In one way, he was, drawing upon classic mythic narratives, I guess you could say, and in one way. But on the other hand, he was very much going against what were the common fantasy writings, like of George MacDonald and the kind of more mythical writers who were writing kind of like fairy tales at the time. And Tolkien obviously didn't write that. He wrote... this monstrosity, beautiful monstrosity, but this unpublishable thing. I mean, The Hobbit is more in the vein of the kinds of fantasy which was more popular at that time, but, and then he writes Lord of the Rings and the world changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now people copy that, look at that, respond to that, run far away from that, like your book, E.B. It's a touchstone to react to positively or negatively. And it's inescapably so.
Yeah, I agree.
It's also kind of sad, though, because he becomes the default comparison.
For epic fantasy, sure, yeah. Well, and now Martin's sort of taking over that territory, too.
That's true, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know if that, how long that will last. But right now, it's like, are you like Martin or not like Martin? That seems to be the sort of the default question, so...
Especially since it's now on television, popular. Yeah, the wider world beyond popular culture, fancy. Oh yeah, that's George R.R. Martin.
That's a relief after years of, so like J.K. Rowling, right? Every time you mention you're writing fantasy,
That's right, yeah. Yes, I'm writing about wizards. Exactly what I'm doing. No,
because,
no.
You know, that's the, you said it, you know, it had seeped out of, you know, the fan base into the popular culture. So you said fantasy to many, many people, and that was it. That was their only context for it.
It's so weird how that works. And yet it's so natural for cultures to kind of, these brief moments of like attachment to an idea or a concept or a thing, in a literary sense. I mean, like, even as soon as the fire from Rowling had started to end, it became the Twilight fire.
Right.
And everyone who wrote a vampire book, and it would be like, oh, so like Twilight. And it's like, well, I mean, they don't glitter. So,
yeah.
But I mean, that becomes the new default comparison, not the comparison I would make, which is when vampires were actually vampires in Anne Rice.
Right.
You know, who it's those cycles are so interesting. And it is, I don't know, it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, in another 10, 15 years, what is the next, like, big thing going to be? Is it going to be like mutant unicorns? And like, we're going to have lots of remakes of Legend.
It's so wide open. It's amazing to me the breadth of what's being published now in fantasy. It's really kind of astounding. Maybe everybody's just throwing their hat in the ring because nobody knows what that next big thing is going to be. But it's a great time. It's a great time to be out there. It's a very satisfying time, I think, to be published right now. I don't know if my book would have been published 5 years ago or 10 years ago or even 3 years ago. But certainly the climate that it's coming out right now is wonderful. I think people are happy to look outside of those very small boxes and say, okay, what have you got for me? You know, I might like it, I might not, but I'll take a chance. You know, let's see what you've got.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It's a great time to be a reader.
That's
of genre.
Yeah.
Or I should say fantasy. Science fiction is unfortunately another problem.
All over the place. You know, urban fantasy and epic fantasy and grim dark fantasy, which I'm still trying to push myself into. I'm not quite sure I can do it.
I don't know.
Your prologue. I'm just saying.
I don't know.
Yeah,
if I would...
it changes, but yeah.
I might disagree that I don't know if it's necessarily a great time for readers. But maybe that's... well, and I say that not because variety isn't good, because I think that's true. I do think that because so much is being published, I think for some readers it becomes very difficult to find something. Because, like, you know, I mean, yes, we're saying that in many respects that fantasy is becoming very big and varied. But at the same time, like, you know, say I like only certain kinds of urban fantasy, because there are actually types, and people may not know this, there are actually like, types. You know, because, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of books published each year, it can be very difficult as a reader to maybe find that one book, you know, I'm going to like that one because it's similar to something else I like. But it's not the broader, fitting into the broader subgenre, but into an even more narrow cast. And so sometimes I worry about that. But that might have more to do with what eBooks has done to the browsing experience, which I hate. But not that I'm running out of things to read. I have lots of stuff to read. So, but I do worry about that the having so much being published, hurts readers on some respect because they might have trouble finding those things they really love. But maybe even in the long run, if I worry that could also hurt writers, because if there's so much variety, how do people even find your book?
Oh, exactly. I mean, that's a fear that I sort of live with every day is, you know, the idea that somewhere out there, there's a reader who would really connect with what I'm doing and they will never, ever, ever find my book. And, you know, there may be other readers who won't connect with it, who will find it in their path because it's been categorized or classified in such a way, you know, and it's really just not right for them. So it's I don't know how we're going to solve this. It's true that it's overwhelming. I mean, you can't try to browse for something on Amazon. Trying to find a book to read by browsing on Amazon is just a complete waste of time that I've found anyway, you know, but I've heard now that they're starting to do some research, and then people will, even people who are really dedicated to their e-readers, will go to the bookstore and browse the books there, and then come home and buy the book on their e-reader.
Showroom,
so
yes.
The gloom and doom of the bookstore thing, I don't know. I have this little spark of optimism that bookstores are going to hang on and maybe morph a little into something a little bit different. But I don't know. I have this faint hope that the bookstore is going to make a comeback. Because exactly that. People need curation.
I suspect that we're not going to see all bookstores like mass die off. That doesn't seem like something that will happen to me. And I think that's going to be because some cities just have book cultures. And, like, I mean, I think a great example is Portland. Portland has a really, really amazing new and used bookstore called Powell's. And, yes, this is a free publicity for them because I love them. And you can go to Powell's.com and you can buy books from them. If you don't like Amazon, you want to buy from them, whatever. But Powell's is in the heart of Portland. It's right near the downtown area where all the shopping is. And it's perfectly placed, but it happens to be in a city where, well, people actually do this thing called reading there. And Portland has its own, like, really, really complex set of, like, mini cultures there. And I think that's going to be true of places like, say, Santa Cruz, where is another place I've lived, which has its own kind of mini book culture. I'm sure San Francisco will always have indie bookstores and other kinds of bookstores because of its size. And then just parts of the world, parts of the country, I think are just going to lose them. They're not going to. At best, they'll have maybe like they'll have a Barnes and Noble or some other chain store nearby, but they won't have like an indie store.
Yeah, I think the suburban sprawl is a really tough place for a bookstore. No. But then, you know, here I am in New York, and, you know, our indie bookstores are few and far between too, just because the cost of owning running one is so extremely high. Now, here you have probably the readership, to, you know, necessary to support one, except that the costs of running it, you know, will never be able to keep pace.
Yeah, unless you're one of those places like Powell's, which is a huge bookstore in which you can get lots of customers in there and you have enough variety to keep the customers coming and coming and coming.
Right, or like the Strand here, you know, the Strand is
the Strand.
I want to go.
You'd love it, Sean. I lived in New York City the first 30 years of my life, E.B., even though I now live in Minneapolis, which is fortunately another book town. But yeah, I love the Strand. Loved it so much.
And it is sad, I mean, that that's what we're coming to with bookstores. But at the same time, I mean, it's – and what matters to me, I think, is that some bookstores survive so that we have that. Because I'm going to be totally honest, I don't know if the e-book – places that are dealing in ebooks are ever going to figure out the browsing to an extent that'll make me happy. So if there are no bookstores for me to go to, I will lose my mind. Because I will go to a Barnes and Noble and I will bring my Nook and I will sit there and I'll look at the covers and I'll go, you know, I want to see if that's actually an ebook form. And I will buy it in the ebook from the Barnes and Noble store, so they're still getting money for me. But it becomes one of those, I can't actually browse. If you ever try to browse on the Barnes & Noble ebook site, it's impossible. It's just, it's like looking through seas and seas of garbage, basically. And that's my fear, is that that's never going to be resolved. And we'll just end up with, you know, trying to find the needles in the haystacks. And it won't even be finding, like, that book that's really good. It'll be the finding a book that has been edited by someone who's professional.
Sean, I'd like to think that shows like ours are at least a small attempt at bringing authors and books to light.
I was going to say. You know, I see the book bloggers. I mean, book bloggers, people can really harsh on the book bloggers, which I think is really a shame because – you know, a book blogger is really doing that curating for you. And, you know, if you follow someone who has, you know, similar tastes, you're going to get pretty good recommendations from them. Or otherwise, you can follow somebody that you know hates everything you like and still get recommendations that way. I mean, yeah. I think that certainly I see more and more of that kind of thing springing up, and that may help.
I agree, and I think that'll be one of the responses to the problem of browsing will be people will go to quote-unquote trusted sources for their book browsing desires, I guess you could say. I just know I'm one of those weirdos that likes to just walk up and down the aisles until something jumps out at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss that.
Yeah. I'm hoping that I think there's a new passionate generation of readers coming up, the Harry Potter generation. And I think I don't think we've seen what they're going to do yet. And I have high hopes for them.
Well, if they're anything like the Twilight generation, they're going to destroy literature as we know it.
No, I mean, you know, these are people who have developed a real passion for reading and for sharing books that they love and for, you know, really sinking their hearts into it.
Yeah. And so that's
what I tell myself anyway as I'm trying to fall asleep at night.
I applaud those people, and I believe that we should love them for hopefully keeping literature going for another 10,000 years. I'm assuming we're going to be here in 10,000 years.
That's an optimistic statement in and of itself.
Yeah. So, Paul, do you have another question, or do you want me to go to my five questions?
I think we're at a good point. We can start wrapping things up.
Okay. All right. So I got five silly questions for you.
Okay.
So you just have to answer them quick. You don't need to give like reasons why, unless you feel really compelled to. Hopefully you won't have to, and you can leave it mysterious. So question number one is, would you rather have a sword that can shoot fire or a sword that can freeze anything it touches?
Sword that can freeze anything.
All right. Would you rather ride on a giant lizard or a small giraffe with wings?
Giant lizard.
You're going to be like in Star Wars. You're Obi-Wan Kenobi. Sorry. That's why I did that. I just hoped that you'd pick the lizard. Okay, number three. Would you rather control dreams or read people's minds?
Oh, God, control dreams. The last thing I'd want to do is read anyone's mind. I have enough of that reading reviews on Amazon. I don't need to get a peek into anyone's psyche.
Fair enough. All right, number four. If you're on a deserted island and you had to choose a boy band to bring with you, and you don't have a choice, you have to bring one, which one would you bring?
Does the Beastie Boys count?
No, they're not a boy band.
That's about as close as I'm going to get. I don't know. God, name some other boy bands.
Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, 98 Degrees, New Kids on the Block.
Which one was Justin Timberlake in?
That was NSYNC.
I'll take them, then.
Okay. All right, good.
He's got a good sense of humor.
At least he can sing that, you know, got that sexy back or whatever that song is, which would be fun. Okay, number five. Okay, so name a book you wish an editor had accidentally dropped down a well, conveniently filled with gasoline, after which a suspicious figure dropped a match inside and then lit it on fire.
Oh, you're asking me to trash a book? It's got to be by a dead author then, because okay. I'm not getting myself into that much trouble. Let's see. Oh, man.
That's a cruel one, Sean.
That is really mean. First of all, the idea of burning any book, even a much hated one, is just...
Sean, why don't we... Sean, I'm sorry, Sean. Let's strike this question entirely.
Okay.
And go to something much, much lighter or fluffier.
Thank you, Paul.
And completely out of left field, gelato or Philadelphia-style ice cream?
Gelato. But I will take a Philly style pork sandwich over just about any other food.
Not cheesesteak, a pork sandwich.
Yeah. What's the name of that restaurant in Philly? Because I grew up outside of Philly.
I know. That's why I threw the Philadelphia ice cream in there.
Nick's. Is it Nick's with the pork sandwiches? There's a place in South Philadelphia that makes a pork sandwich that I dream about. Anyone who's from Philly is now screaming the name out into the ether, but I don't know it. There's nothing. A cheesesteak is great, don't get me wrong, but that pork sandwich just dripping with juice, that is a thing of beauty.
So what is Philadelphia style ice cream?
It is Nick's.
Yeah, it's a vanilla ice cream with vanilla flakes and flecks in it, so it's got that nice white creamy texture with the vanilla bean. It's really, really good. But
yeah, my mother loved that. I never really liked that. I like gelato. I like the flavors. Not a big vanilla person.
All right, so that's what the difference is. Now I understand. 'Cause I'm from the West Coast, and we still ride horses and stuff out there, so because we haven't quite got up to the standards of gelato and Philadelphia style ice cream.
What? So riding horses is somehow antithetical to appreciating ice cream? I kind of missed that connection.
We have to churn our own butter, so we really just don't. We don't make ice cream. That's just too much damn work. So anyway, jumping away then all this, and we'll close this out here. So what can folks expect from you in the next year in terms of writing and that kind of stuff?
Well, this is a trilogy, or it's designed to be a trilogy. So in theory, there will be two more books. Working on the second one now, and then the third one to follow that. And that's as far as I've got planned.
Awesome. So hopefully we'll get more stuff from you, and you can come back.
Oh, that would be incredible. This has been so much fun.
Where can people find you online, Evie?
I have a website, a much neglected blog, eviemanieri.com. And I love Twitter, so you can get me on Evie Manieri is my Twitter handle. And I'm also on Facebook.
Awesome. And we'll make sure there's links to all that so people can find exactly where to go. So just go to the show notes and you can find the links there just in case you have issues spelling, which it's understandable since there's a lot of vowels.
Yeah, I know. When I saw it on the book cover, I'm like, man, there's a lot of I's and E's in there.
Well, you stole them from some other author. yeah. So it was really great to have you on to talk about Blood's Pride, and it was just fun. And I appreciate you being basically the first for having us be your first podcast is the way I was going to put that. So
it is an honor. It's
definitely painless. Thank you guys so much. I had a great time.
Sure.
Excellent.
Cool. And we'll see everybody else next week.
Say goodnight, everyone.
Oh, we're saying goodnight. Oh, bye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.